Hello, this is Rachel Babin from Oncology News Australia, proud producers of the Oncology Journal Club. This week we have a very special episode for you. We are exploring what happens when the oncologist gets cancer. Three incredible guests share their unique, very personal stories of cancer with us. We start with a giant in the Australian oncology world, Professor Grant MacArthur, who is director of the VCCC and a prostate cancer survivor. We hear from our friend Mark Lewis from the US, who shares his experiences as a physician patient who has multiple neuroendocrine neoplasia type 1. He is an avid Twitter user and even live tweeted his Whipple surgical procedure in 2017. We then close this special episode with a poignant and moving interview with Heidi Probst, Professor of Radiotherapy and Oncology at Sheffield Hallam University in the UK. In 2018, Heidi was diagnosed with stage 2B breast cancer, and she underwent surgery, chemotherapy, and radiotherapy. This experience has had a profound effect on her work. Thank you to Grant, Mark, and Heidi for trusting us with these personal experiences. And thank you, as ever, to Eva Sekulov for her incredibly insightful questions. I hope you enjoy today's episode and find it valuable in your practice. And if you'd like to be notified when new podcast episodes are released, then why not sign up to our weekly publication, The Oncology Newsletter, on oncologynews.com.au. It's free and it's a great way to support the OJC. This is Rachel Babin, and this is the Oncology Podcast.
This is our very special edition on people who work in oncology who themselves have had cancer. It's not an easy topic because I think one of the ways we cope is we say the patient has cancer, we don't. So what happens when you are yourself diagnosed with cancer? And how do people cope? What would you do? I've always thought that that's the day that I stop practicing cancer medicine. It's an absolute pleasure to welcome back to Oncology Journal Club podcast our friend Grant MacArthur, well known to all of us, not only in Australia, but internationally, for his role as head of the VCCC, for his expert research career in melanoma, clinical trials and translational research. And in fact, we had a whole episode on getting to know Grant. So welcome, Grant.
Great to be back with you, Eva.
And Grant, you're on this very special edition of the podcast, and it is something that not everybody may know about you. And this is really where the person and the profession collide. So this is our special episode on oncologists who get cancer. And I must say, we're very, very privileged that you've agreed to talk to us. You've said no questions off limit. Grant, tell us briefly your brush with cancer. Or do you hate that term?
Well, let's comment on the brush. And, you know, I think if you've got a non-melanoma skin cancer that gets cut out and that's the end of it, that's a brush. But, you know, a lot of cancer is far from a brush, right? Because it's life-changing events in many ways. I believe we all in our profession and really everyone in life should be learning your whole life. And, you know, I think actually that having cancer and the way it impacts your life is a real learning experience for life, but particularly, you know, as a oncologist and healthcare professional. So to tell you about my story. So I, interestingly, when my GP used to hand me blood test form because I've got high cholesterol for tests, he'd had a standard suite of tests he did, which included a PSA for a bloke, you know, 50 years and over. And I used to cross it out because I did not believe in PSA screening. I had, you know, concerns about it. And actually used to have it on the form even before I was 50, to be honest. But then when I got to 50, he said, okay, what about a digital rectal exam? I said, yeah, that's fine, you know, to do that as screening anyway. So he did that. Sure enough, he said, I don't like the feel of your prostate gland. That led to PSA, which was quite elevated at 18. And it's interesting, you know, when one thinks about, you know, the way you get information as a patient from your doctor and the way you deal with it. And of course, being in the profession, you deal with it completely differently to the average person. So I basically put two and two together, you know, digital rectal exam, not quite right, quite a high PSA. This is not going to be prostatitis. This is cancer. So immediately. So, and from there, you know, I went through a path of, interestingly, had one of the first PSMA PET scans in Victoria, which confirmed a PSMA positive tumour. So that's prostate specific membrane antigen. And it had quite high localised uptake, no metastases. But really then, you know, without even a biopsy, it was pretty clear this was prostate cancer. So I went and had the combination of rectal and perineal biopsies to make the diagnosis. Then interestingly, the things that one does, you know, with regards to your work, when you get a, you know, a diagnosis of ill health, you know, a lot of people probably in our community at that point in time would have taken things a bit quiet. But I had to give a plenary talk at the European Society of Medical Oncology. I think it was in Madrid, if I remember correctly. And, you know, you don't give up your plenary talk. So I jumped on the plane, had to take, you know, the anti-spasm medication so I didn't go into acute urinary retention on flight to Spain. And I got there and gave the talk and came back. Actually, I remember it was quite funny because I was on the plane and, you know, don't you hate it, Eva, when you get those, you know, they don't turn off the seatbelt light and they want to keep you in your seat forever. And, you know, I just had this bloody prostate biopsy and I really needed to pass some urine. It was getting quite uncomfortable, so eventually I just stood up. I said, I really need to go, and so I did. Anyway, it's interesting, those things that frustrate you. But anyway, so I got back and then went, and, you know, all the workup was interesting too. What I did was, it's actually what you learn about yourself. And, you know, I've looked after many doctors, and what doesn't work well, in my opinion, is when the patient tries to become the doctor when they're a doctor. That does not go well.
Common problem.
Yeah, I just took the opposite view, that I had a lot of faith in my colleagues and was, you know, to use the term obedience, but of course, you know, we had a dialogue and, you know, wasn't keen on androgen deprivation, wasn't really keen on prolonged courses of radiotherapy, and so went for a radical prostatectomy, which was a robotic prostatectomy. Lots of controversy there, of course, as to is it really superior. But what really caught my attention were two pieces of information about making the decision to go with that. One was a very simple explanation from my urologist. I really like the robotics because you can actually see deep down into the pelvis much better than you can with an open. And I thought, yeah, that makes sense. And then there's data that the blood transfusion rates after radical prostatectomy versus open are virtually zero, which says there's less tissue damage, get back to work and other lifestyle things quicker. So anyway, I recovered pretty well. I took off about 5.5 weeks from work. I was, rather than rushing back, it astounded me that in the United States, routine after a radical prostatectomy is back to work in 2 weeks. That's just crazy stuff. Anyway, I took actually about 5.5 and came back, and all's been good now, 6.5 years later with PSAs. My tiny claim to fame was that 12 weeks after my radical prostatectomy, I got on my bicycle and did personal best times up both Falls Creek and Mount Hotham. So
fantastic.
So that's actually a pretty good ad for the robotic prostatectomy, actually, that you're back on your feet pretty quick. So
you've left something out. I remember one of my very good colleagues back in New South Wales, about the same age, just over 50, had to have this. And I remember about 2 months after he had it, he rang me up yelling and he goes, I'm on the train and there's a nice looking lady and I've just had an erection.
Ah,
he was so excited.
Yes. So actually now I will share with you, we said no, you know, nothing's off limits. So
We've got to put sex in our Oncology Journal Club podcast to get an audience.
We all need more sex, yes. So you do actually, with a diagnosis of prostate cancer where you have to have your prostate dealt with, of course, by whatever means, you know, the issues around continence and erectile function, clearly front of mind. And I was, you know, I told my urologist I'm not very keen on that. And, you know, he reassured me that in a young bloke who's fit, you know, incontinence rates are, you know, not far off zero. And I never had any issues, actually. I had my catheter out and I was almost continent within a day or so. So, you know, that he was quite right there. He was also right, and interestingly, that I had stage 3 prostate cancer with a high likelihood on pre-prostatectomy imaging that there was extra capture extension quite close to some of the, you know, nerves that surround the prostate gland, which is why you get erectile dysfunction when you perturb the prostate with whatever modality. And so it was pretty clear that, you know, on one side this looked like extra capture extension, so stage 3 prostate cancer and quite a high PSA. So he said, and this is what I love about, you know, good workup. So I had, you know, as well as a PSMA PET scan, had an MRI scan, clearly predicted that I have to sacrifice your nerves on one side, right? So therefore, you know, my chances of erectile dysfunction would go up significantly as opposed to very localized disease where you can do nerve sparing surgery. So I spared my nerves on one side and had to sacrifice them on the other. And then it's interesting the things you do. So I, you know, discussions about, you know, sexual performance and stuff, you know, I went off and actually wanted to know the literature myself about recovery of erectile function. So the biggest predictor, actually, recovery of erectile function following prostatic surgery is what your function was like before the prostatectomy. So if you've got erectile dysfunction beforehand, you tend to do bad. And, you know, mine was all right. So
can you train?
Yep.
You're good at training.
Yeah, I never got offered a decent training program, unfortunately, by the team. You know, this is what you got to do. Did all the pelvic floor physio and everything, but no real sexual training program, unfortunately. You know, I had a program of taking, you know, inhibitors for, you know, regularly to begin with and so forth. Now, what's interesting for me, rather than, you know, 8 weeks later, you know, getting an erection on a train, that didn't happen to me. It actually took me, the recovery took a couple of years, actually, which was interesting. I remember Tony Costello, our in Victoria senior urologist who actually pioneered a lot of the nerve sparing surgery, was, you know, made the point that it can take time. So, yeah, it took quite some time, actually, to recover. So,
okay, Grant, thank you. That it really is valuable to share those things. I'm going to go back to the diagnosis and say, presumably you weren't expecting it, obviously you're at the GP. How did you break it to your family and how did you deal with that patient doctor role in terms of, you know, were you advising your family from a sort of a doctor role or a patient role?
They approach that very much from, you know, the patient role, the father, the husband. I brought my wife into full confidence right from the get-go. You know, I think we've all seen as oncologists people that try to protect, you know, their spouses and partners by holding information that always ends bad. So, you know, I brought Marie, my partner, in very early, but then waited for, you know, when I thought I had the definitive diagnosis before I spoke to my kids. And they at the time, you know, were 14, 17, 20. So I spoke to them, you know, one after the other. They, you know, the older ones are always doing stuff. So, had to, you know, it was never easy to actually find time to talk to them, but I did. And, you know, the mistake I made was I didn't give them a very soft landing on this news. I was just pretty blunt. Oh, you know, I've got cancer, you know. And then, you know, what a mistake that was, because then, of course, you know, there's the panic sets in their minds and, you know, you've got to spend time recovering and getting information across rather than taking a softer landing of, you know, working up, oh, this has happened and that's happened and this is a diagnosis and actually the prognosis is pretty good for prostate cancer. And I was just blunt. Oh, you know, I've got cancer. Pretty much as blunt as that. So, yeah.
So do you think that's because you're an oncologist? Is some sort of, like, you'd never say to your patient when they walked in, you've got cancer?
No, that's a great question, Eva. And I think, yes, there's definitely an element of that. I mean, you know, I have a personality type that I tend to be a bit direct anyway, but I think that coupled with, you know, I've got a lot of information, you know, at my fingertips, and I was fully informed and understood, you know, what was going to go on, and where, you know, they did not, but I didn't sort of walk them through it the way that would have been, you know, ideal. And that really, you know, that's one of the learnings too. You know, I've been a lot more focused since my diagnosis when I talk to my patients and their families about how you talk to each other about your cancer. You know, you learn from your own experience of not doing things well.
What about your colleagues? So obviously you want to be treated by people you trust, but that also means there's a sort of privacy issue and a boundaries issue. How did you cope with that?
When you're in senior, reasonably prominent position and, you know, you have a significant health problem, you know, I had seen, you know, misinformation occur about people in experience that there's, you know, people can assume that, you know, this is advanced disease and it's terminal and they treat you differently. So I decided I would manage the communications, you know, emailed a summary to all my colleagues and took charge of the information giving. And that was great because, you know, people knew the info, they respected, you know, the way I was dealing with it, and it all ran very smoothly, rather than trying to keep everything private, and then no doubt there'll be rumours and information getting out anyway. So decided to be on the front foot and take control, and that was a very good thing to do, I think.
I think it may be a little bit easier if the news is very good and favourable, though.
Yeah.
A bit harder if the news isn't good. But how long did it take you to actually believe it? Was part of going and giving the plenary sort of almost an out-of-body experience? This is my normal life. The other thing can't be happening.
I actually don't think I had denial, because it was when I got the PSA, you know, I knew, right? And then by the time I gave the plenary, I'd had the biopsy and I'd had the PSMA PET scan. So, you know, that it was more about something as professionals, we just define so much in our lives by our work that you just put work as a top priority in your life, right? So, you know, nowadays, of course, I would have just been able to do it online from Australia, would have all been good. But no, in those days, you've got to be there live. So
Grant, what other impact has having the diagnosis and going through that treatment had on how you practice, not only with individual patients, but the course that your career's taken?
Yeah, Eva, thanks. That's a really, really good question that I do reflect upon. You know, I've got two different components to the answer. The first one was, really interestingly, I got interviewed by Neil Mitchell, who I know quite well and done some stuff on various issues and cancer with him over the years. So he did an interview pretty early on about my experience and asked me, oh, how has it changed you as a doctor? And I said, no, not, you know, hasn't changed me at all. No, that was wrong, because that was pretty early days. So there's no doubt that I'm more attuned and think more about patients, you know, emotional responses to their cancer and the way they interact with their families. I pay relatively more attention to it now. I used to feel that I was pretty orientated that way anyway, but definitely, you know, more sympathy, empathy, you know, focusing on those things. The second thing is interesting that, and one of the reasons why I really, you know, love my current role as executive director of the Victorian Comprehensive Cancer Centre, is it's occurred to me that, you know, I was very fortunate in that, you know, obviously high health literacy in oncologists gets cancer, you know, you know the drill. But, you know, I landed in a, you know, with a great team and great advice and, you know, well looked after. But I don't want a health system where your outcomes and experience will be determined by where you happen to land, where you happen to be referred by your, you know, clinician that makes the initial referrals. You know, we want the same outcomes for everyone of cancer, no matter where they hit our system. And that drives me. So I use my own experience as a driving force, because I feel so fortunate, and I know there are those that, you know, are not so fortunate.
What about the healthy lifestyle aspect? Did you feel sort of ripped off that you spent all that time on the bike and you still got cancer? We do hear that from patients who, you know, get upset that they've done everything right, in inverted commas.
Well, look, I understand cancer biology pretty well. So, yeah, that thought never went through my mind because I know the bad luck factor is huge. But I have reflected, as I think everyone would, on possible, you know, steps that might have been taken differently. First of all, you know, I've got a family history of prostate cancer. So in retrospect, I should have had a PSA test and in screening, you know, with a family history, and then might have got diagnosed a bit earlier. Now, as it turns out, I'm 6.5 years now. What would have been better if I'd been diagnosed earlier? Well, I probably wouldn't have had to sacrifice the, you know, the nerves on one side of my prostate gland. And, you know, the erectile dysfunction would have been less, I think, if I got treated earlier. So in retrospect, yes, I should have had PSA screening with a family history. The other very interesting thing, actually, there is one interesting study in the UK suggesting cyclists get more prostate cancer, which the mechanism is perhaps thought to be due to chronic prostatitis from the sitting on a saddle for many hours, you know, bouncing around. You know, all these studies potentially have methodological issues, though, and cyclists are probably more likely to get a PSA done and more likely to be diagnosed. So, but there is one interesting study, you know, quite a large study actually, that suggested that. So maybe my cycling contributed to it. But now with no prostate, I don't have to worry, so I can ride as far and as often as I like.
Ah, that's a really interesting fact.
Now, I am joking, of course. I'm not suggesting that cyclists give up their sport because they'll get prostate cancer. That's far from proven in any way at all.
Of course. So, Grant, the learnings that you've had from this experience, did you ever encounter any sort of fear of recurrence? And what would be, do you think an oncologist would have a greater fear of recurrence or be more reassured at the time point like you that, you know, it's unlikely to come back now?
Yeah, actually, I was just thinking, preparing for the interview, I haven't checked my conditional survival, you know, for the last 6 months to see where I'm at. Last time I checked, I was about a 15% chance of relapse. I started at 30 when I was first diagnosed, so, which says really that I don't reflect much upon it. I tell you what my biggest fear is. My biggest fear is if I get recurrence, having to go on androgen deprivation therapy, which is doesn't appeal to me at all. Try to encourage my colleagues doing research in prostate cancer. Hey, you know, Nobel Prize for androgen deprivation was about 80 or 90 years ago, guys. How about you move into some more modern therapies for this disease and don't have to castrate men and all the problems associated with that, because, you know, the fatigue, the psychological impacts of androgen deprivation, loss of muscle mass, you know, like my cycling and things, you know, it would be, you know, wouldn't be able to keep up with my riding buddies anymore because I've lost muscle mass from, you know, that's my biggest fear, to be honest, rather than death. You know, we're all going to die one day. We know that very well, Eva, as oncologists, right? I mean, you have, you know, the frailty of human life, you know, every day we see it. So I'm not so fussed with that. But, it's having to go on to a therapy and the dynamic, right? The oncologist, urologist offers you androgen deprivation therapy. Marie, my partner's in the room. Yes, Grant, but this will improve your survival. Well, I don't really want it. How do you negotiate that? You know, that's my biggest fear.
It's an interesting one, Grant, though, isn't it? Because if you think about women with breast cancer, particularly premenopausal women who are also offered deprivation therapy that has a profound impact, perhaps there's not as much attention paid to that. Do you think there's a gender issue there?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. So, look, I think there's huge unconscious bias when it comes to gender in our profession, which has been for a long time male orientated. And you're probably right, Eva, that there is probably some bias there. You know, the male oncologist trivializing the side effects of the endocrine therapy for women, I think, occurs. And, you know, I've seen that in my career. Oh, lucky to be alive, you know. You know, hopefully people are changing and they're really focusing on quality of survivorship, you know, which I think is really, you know, an important area. And particularly in prostate cancer, which potentially, you know, we're over-treating, you know, some cases.
So let's talk about survivorship. Should you be at a survivorship clinic, Grant, and what might you get out of it as a clinician? Or is that only for people who don't have the knowledge we have?
What a wonderful question, Eva, because I have on the one hand a philosophy which I've taken all along. I've got a GP. I see them regularly, take their advice. You know, I don't believe in being your own doctor. However, I don't go to survivorship clinics or do any sort of survivorship care because I feel that a lot of that stuff's pretty personal and I can just deal with it myself. So I'm breaking my rule because I'm, you know, doing it myself rather than seeking advice, because certainly I believe, you know, in quality of life in survivorship and reducing the burden of cancer survivorship is extremely important area. And it's something that we need to systematize, take a very research-led approach to understanding the best way of delivering that care. However, you know, I'm not voting with my feet, am I? Because I sort of do that myself.
So let me get this right. You crossed off the PSA with a family history of prostate cancer. You didn't take your ADT and you're not doing survivorship. So would you say you're a model patient?
Far from it, Eva. You've summed it up beautifully, right? That's right. So although I have this philosophy of being looked after and listening to my clinician, yes, I don't really practice what I preach there, do I? You know, what is, as I think we've seen, though, with our colleagues, you know, the number of not just medical colleagues, but also scientists and other senior people around the healthcare sector that don't have a general practitioner at all, you know, that is, you know, is really worrisome to me. I do see my GP regularly and take their advice. And however, when it comes to a few things there, clearly I'm not practicing what I preach.
Well, I mean, that's the whole issue, isn't it, about public health and prevention versus personalised approach. Everyone is so different about what they value and where they put those values. And so I think what's been interesting is that that same dilemma comes for a clinician, an oncologist who gets cancer. You still weigh things up and might do something against the evidence or interpret the evidence so that you don't feel it's right for you. And that's why we're all individuals. And that's something we should all remember with our patients as well, if we get frustrated that they're not doing, in inverted commas, what we told them.
Yeah, and I think, you know, patient choice is a key part of evidence-based medicine. We can't forget that. It's not one size fits all. We certainly assess the, you know, the data in making recommendations, but you can't take patient preference out of the whole field of evidence-based medicine. It's squarely got to be a very important part of it.
So I'm going to ask another sort of personal question now. Did you have income protection insurance and did you get a payout with this diagnosis? Because it's something that I've found a lot of people, even in our profession, are quite unaware of.
Yeah, so I had income protection, but I did not have, forgotten the exact term for it now, but sentinel event, you know, insurance whereby a diagnosis of cancer, you get a lump sum sort of thing. I did not have that. But I did have income protection. I had life insurance. And one of the great things for 2021 for me has been ditching it, because I've got to an age now where the premiums are so high and happy to self-insure. Kids are, you know, on the path to being fully independent. Put the line through that stuff now. And would I have done things differently? I don't know. You know, I think I didn't really need a payout as a, you know, for a diagnosis of prostate cancer. However, you know, you have insurance in case, you know, bad stuff happens. You know, I'm glad that I had income protection and life insurance for all the years, and you know, to help support my family should bad things happen. But, you know, I'm at an age now where I can put all that behind me, which is rather nice.
All right. Well, Grant, any final comments that you want to give our listeners? Did you find it hard coming back, or did you feel from the start that actually you could use this experience to make yourself a better oncologist and perform your leadership roles better?
Yeah, look, my simple message I opened up with it actually was that, you know, there's a lot to learn in life. You keep learning your whole life, particularly as a professional. So you've got to use these experiences to make yourself, you know, a better doctor and keep learning from your patients on day-to-day basis, from your colleagues, and stay focused on the needs of your patient, and you'll be a great doctor and a great oncologist.
Well, that certainly sums you up in that last sentence, Grant. We all look up to you. We thank you for your mentorship, your leadership, and for this interview, for your honesty and for the insights that you've given us. I think we also learn not only from our own experience, but from others and others who we respect. So thank you very much, Grant. It's been really a very special interview for me.
Thanks, Eva. Great pleasure and great to be involved.
What a great interview. Thank you, Eva, and thank you, Grant. If you enjoyed this interview, you may like to listen to our interview with Grant from 2020 for our OJC Meets series. You'll find a link in the notes. In 2020, we also spoke to Mark Lewis as part of our OJC Meets series. Next, you'll hear comments from this extended interview as Mark talks about his own experience of a genetic tumor syndrome, a syndrome that affected his father and now affects his son. So, back to you, Eva.
Listeners, we've got one of the most influential and prolific tweeters, oncology tweeters. It's how I came to know about Mark. If you haven't followed him, you are missing out. He is something to behold, but has a fascinating story. And we're very, very privileged to interview him. It's going to be great fun. So, Mark, you were born in Scotland.
That's right. This is the part where I get to pull out the accent. So, I was born in Edinburgh and moved to Texas when I was 8 years old. And actually, that's kind of where, unfortunately, my story with oncology begins, because when you come to the States, it's a public health measure that you get a chest X-ray, essentially to make sure you're not bringing tuberculosis into the country. And my father, who we thought was in good health, he was a 42-year-old man, really had no vices to speak of. We found that he had a very large mass opacifying his right chest. Got a very impersonal call from the embassy saying, there's an abnormality here. It's not tuberculosis. It's something else. You know, sort it out when you get to the States. And so essentially from the moment we landed in the US, we had to engage with the healthcare system, which was obviously quite different than what we were used to in the UK. My father required a pneumonectomy, which was unfortunately insufficient to remove the tumor from his mediastinum. So then he required radiation, and then he required pretty brutal chemo. So that's kind of my origin story, is when we landed here, my dad had cancer. He ultimately passed from that when he was 49 and I was 14, a very formative age. And I was very fortunate, though, that his oncologist, I think, really felt for me, realized I had an interest in both art and science of oncology. I took me under his wing, almost like an apprenticeship, and I spent every summer working for him. And so worked my way through the clinic and started just taking vital signs. I was an x-ray tech for a while. And that's how I got interested in oncology. I hope it's an authentic interest. And it's one that sustains me, because I think often about the treatment my father sustained, which at the time was considered state of the art, and now seems almost indiscriminately toxic and brutal. And I'm thrilled with the progress that we've made. You know, we have miles to go before we sleep. The other twist to my story is that when I realized that my father had died not just of a cancer, but of a hereditary syndrome, I'm actually diagnosed myself with a germline defect. So I carry the gene for multiple endocrine neoplasia type 1. And the reason that plays in here is, as I was leading up to one of my surgeries, the Whipple operation in 2017, I realized, you know, I really have a chance here to advocate in a way that a lot of people can't. And you know, we can talk about the differences between Australian and American healthcare, but frankly, there's still a fair amount of stigma, and I would say even discrimination here, where some patients are afraid to raise their voices. And I'm in a very privileged position where not only am I professionally familiar with how oncology works, my employers are incredibly encouraging that I be vocal. So when I was going through my Whipple operation, I made a very conscious decision, again, with the help of my kind of local social media team, to really be explicit about that whole process, the beginning, the middle, and the end. And so I approached it more as a patient than as a doctor, quite frankly. And I think that's where sort of the more human side of my Twitter account came through, is that I wanted people to know that oncologists are human beings. You know, if you've ever done a Google search and allowed Google to auto-complete your phrase, one day I was horrified. I put in oncologists are, and the answers were like oncologists are murderers, oncologists are criminals. And, you know, I think, again, the not entirely proud history of very significant side effects that the general public is aware of have, I think that's colored their perception of us as specialists. And I don't want them to be afraid of us. You know, our mutual interest is in helping people with their cancer. And if they're dissuaded from even meeting us in the first place, that's to no one's best interest. So anyway, my point is I try to sort of wear both hats on social media and be a patient and a doctor. And you're right. At the end of a clinic day, without divulging anyone's privacy, I like to speak to the fact this is, I think, a very humane profession. And for all the science of it, so much of it is emotional. The day it stops being emotional is the day I want to stop doing it, because if I become insensate to the human side of this, then I'm just a kind of a chemo dispensing robot, and that's exactly what I don't want to be. So yeah, that's my bicameral mind on Twitter. I'm very lucky to engage in dialogue with brilliant colleagues around the world like you, but I also want to, you know, vocalize and even diarize my experience as a patient. Because the last piece of the puzzle is my son has inherited the same defect from me. And I'm probably kidding myself that he's ever going to bother trawling through all my tweets. But I did want to kind of create an ongoing experience, if you will, sort of an open diary of what it's like to be a patient, because one day he's going to have to deal with this too.
Wow. Look, I do need to pick you up on, because I did read on your Twitter feed that you said you did your own Whipples. Was that fake news?
No. So one of my patients, I don't know if this happens to you as a medical oncologist, but you know, some of the patients come in with this preconceived notion that we're one-stop shopping and I'll be doing not only the chemo, but also the surgery and the radiation. And I quickly disabuse them of that notion because the last thing I'm good at is surgery. I realized that very quickly in my career. However, the other day, to the next level, I've never had this inquiry before. Someone asked me if I did my own Whipple, which would really be straining my manual dexterity. You know, I cited the example of the doctor who performed, I believe, her own appendectomy at the South Pole when she had appendicitis. But the Whipple is even more complex than that, as you're well aware. So no, I did not perform my own Whipple, and I certainly don't want that rumor getting out there. And I feel very fortunate because I'm really a patient first. I'm always a patient. I'm a patient physician, and I do live on both sides of the hyphenate. But I really view myself as a patient that's just very well-positioned professionally, and I'm very lucky in that respect. I had a medical student once say, how did you get popular? I said, well, to be honest with you, I live tweeted my own Whipple and I don't recommend doing that. It was also my patients commented that I lost weight after my Whipple and it's one of the most extreme diets I could think of. So I'm not going to recommend it from that angle either. But to be very honest with you, I've been incredibly lucky, even medically. I've not yet required chemo. So sometimes when I identify with patients with cancer, I'm very careful because I realize so far I haven't really had anything treatment-wise that's systemic. As you know, it's very different than the vast majority of patients that would be in a medical oncology practice. So I don't want to come across like I'm stealing valor from them. But on the other hand, I do understand what it's like to do sort of the risk-benefit calculus of a life-changing event. And when I was having my surgery, it was to prevent metastases. So far, that's been successful. But you know, the night before the operation, the numbers that I had been cited for intraoperative and postoperative mortality started to really kind of loom large in my head. And I realized that when we cite statistics to people, they can come off as very, you know, kind of cold and dispassionate. But that number is going to end up meaning something to the person that you're trying to counsel. And so that's maybe a lot more hopefully sensitive around statistics in oncology, because we love to cite them. Medical oncologists love numbers. We love our endpoints. As it turns out, very few of the endpoints that we think are so important really matter on a really core level to our patients. And that's part of the dialogue in oncology, is taking all the sort of math and science that we have and really trying to artfully apply it to each patient's situation.
You're such a nice guy. I honestly thought you might be a real dick from your Twitter, but it's great.
That's fantastic. I love it. That's great.
But Mark, many people use that boundary between doctor and patient to protect themselves as an oncologist. You've smashed that boundary. Doesn't that leave you too vulnerable?
Yeah, you know, thank you for bringing that up. Again, I'm not putting my Twitter account forward as an exemplar for everybody else. And there certainly have been some very unpleasant experiences, to be honest with you, of people being not just personally insulting, but frankly, almost threatening to my family. I try to represent myself as a dad and a husband. But unfortunately, that's sometimes it made them vulnerable. And that's not fair because I'm the one that does this, not them. So I've learned some lessons about trying to firewall off some of my very personal life. But other than that, I really am, I think, most useful as an open book. And it's really interesting in the era of internet and shared decision making, to the extent that they have latitude to pick their doctor, some patients, and I'm enormously flattered by this, seek me out. They're looking for someone that they think can empathize with them. And I'm very careful, as I said earlier, not to overplay my hand and say, listen, I understand exactly what chemo's like. I understand, you know, this taste of my own medicine. But on the other hand, I think all things considered, they do want an oncologist who's being thoughtful about, you know, decisions that are being made for and about them. And so it's hugely rewarding when someone, especially with a rare tumor, seeks me out because they're looking for someone with understanding that might go beyond the textbook. And that really has been the most rewarding thing of all. Of everything on Twitter, and I've made some wonderful professional partnerships. To the extent that it is still appropriate, I've made some wonderful connections with patients too. My wife often says, if you want a response from me, you either have to text me or tweet me. In fact, to a very interesting degree, on the day of my operation, she was actually getting more live updates about my surgery from Twitter than she was from the operating room team, because they were obviously very engrossed in what they were doing. And I'm glad that they were. So that was a really interesting experience for us as a family to sort of, again, give live sort of progress reports to my spouse about this big surgery through social media, which was, again, an open platform. So it was kind of surreal. Twitter is wide open. I always warn people that whatever you put on Twitter, you should expect anybody, including your patients or colleagues, to be able to read it. But again, for me, that's actually great for my patients, and it really encourages dialogue. And I probably sound like an awful narcissist, but often we have conversations in clinic that are sparked by something that they've read from my stream. And that, again, it really brings out the human side of oncology. And I think when they see me as someone that sort of gets what they're going through, it really opens up the conversation. And it's so much less paternalistic than I think it might have used to be. I think that the two-way conversation can be done now much more realistically than before.
So you were very open about your diagnosis. I have a colleague recently diagnosed who hasn't disclosed to anyone. I think that's the more common scenario. There's this sudden period of leave, maybe discloses to a very few people.
Yes.
Is that just personal choice, or are they missing out on something?
Yeah, no, I think it's deeply personal. And I mean, as you know, confidentiality is one of the things that we genuinely hold sacrosanct in medicine. I will say here in the States, it's interesting. There's a distinction here to be made between sporadic and hereditary diagnoses. So to be honest with you, in my sort of fervor to get a label for what was wrong with myself and my family, I really did rush into the testing, and I didn't fully explore, slightly to my detriment, the ways in which it could affect not just my employment, but my insurance. I know that sounds probably quite selfish, but it's actually a message I preach to my patients, is that, you know, sadly, we don't have ironclad protection against genetic discrimination. So for instance, in the States, your life insurance can go up, your certain forms of health insurance can go up. You're not supposed to be discriminated against by your employer, but as you might imagine, there's unfortunately ways around that if your boss decides that you're more of a liability than an asset to the company. So I think it's a deeply personal decision. Again, it's one that's made sense for me because it's such a part of my identity to be a patient and speak up about that. But I realize it's not for everybody. And kind of like you, I have medical colleagues, I've been their confidant, and they don't want anyone else to know, and I completely respect that. One of the things that was amazing about my training is when I sort of announced during my fellowship that I had this syndrome, so many of my consulting physicians and attendings kind of took me aside and discreetly said, you know, I've dealt with cancer. And I have a pet theory, actually, that oncologists, and this may sound a little wild, I think we're occupationally slightly more likely to deal with cancer in our own lives than other specialties, because there's usually a deep-seated reason that we go into the field. Yes, you can love the science and you're completely about, you know, look at the progress we're making, and that's very exciting. But I find, not too far below the surface, that most of us have some sort of emotional link to the disease. And when that's someone in our family, then you start to kind of compound familial risk. So I know it sounds a little bit crazy, but most of the oncologists that I know have had a personal brush with the disease that compounds their interest in the science and then really draws them into the field.
So, Mark, in your own journey as a patient, what are you fearful of in the future?
Oh, great question. To be honest with you, and I think most parents experience this, And I know it's a cliche, but I think it's a cliche because it's true. You'd rather go through something yourself than see your kids go through it. And again, I'm a perfect example of autosomal dominant inheritance because I've got two children, I've got a 12-year-old daughter and a 9-year-old son, and she doesn't have it, and my son does. And he watched me go through the Whipple, and it was a very transparent experience. My wife is a pediatrician, so she's an expert in childcare. And we made a very sort of purposeful choice as a dual physician couple that we weren't going to shield our kids from this. We were going to show them what this looked like. But that said, it's a very invasive way to minimize your risk. And so I guess my greatest fear is that my son's going to have to go through all of the same things that either his now late grandfather or I have had to go through. I do see a trend, as I mentioned earlier, of things getting more effective and more tolerable. There's a whole other conversation we could have around CRISPR and gene editing and the pluses and minuses of splicing up the genome like that. It's possible that one day a mutation like ours could be banished, I imagine, with sort of surgical precision. But in the meantime, we have surgical imprecision. We have these big operations that take out, you know, very vital organs to provide us with protection and treatment. So that's my biggest fear. I honestly, you know, my father died when he was 49. One of the things he did, which was remarkable, is he wrote a book while he was going through chemo. And one of the things he writes in there is, you know, we're not guaranteed 3 score years and 10. He was a theologian. He was referring to the Psalms there. And that always stuck with me. Like, you know, especially in COVID, I think in oncology, we're often aware of mortality. I think COVID has shone a light of uncertainty and tenuousness on everybody. And I think that's definitely disturbed the public consciousness. What I'm getting at is none of us know exactly how long we have. I don't really fear death so much as I fear, you know, what this is going to do for my family. And it's tough too, because I'm an only child. And so I sort of feel like I could have broken the chain of any one of my family if I hadn't passed it on to my son. But on the other hand, when we were deciding to have kids, the technologies by which you are manipulating embryos, trying to edit out the culprit mutation, I'm not saying they're unethical. They just didn't feel right for us as a couple. And then finally, on a very existential note, if my parents had done that to me, I wouldn't be here, at least not in the way I know myself. So it was kind of strange to think of editing that out of existence. So it's a weird problem to have. So long answer short, I'm less worried about my own future because I think I've taken good steps to protect my health. I really worry more about my boy.
So it really is a fascinating insight, Mark, because we do identify sometimes as patients or family members who've had cancer, but that double whammy of a genetic syndrome with cancer, you've really given us an insight into that perspective that probably I had underappreciated.
I think it's a healthy or unhealthy amount of Protestant guilt on my behalf. And the other thing that goes in there is that my father was a minister. His father before him was a minister. I'm literally the first person in generations not to go into the clergy. And some of my psychologizing there has been to tell myself, and I think it's true actually, that what we do is kind of a secular form of care. I find medicine really fascinating because you get to have such, and again, I mean this in the most appropriate way, intimate encounters with people. And in oncology in particular, you're wrestling with these huge issues, you know, life and death. And again, I'm not saying it's religion, it's not. But for me, at least, it feels like the kind of pastoral care that my father and his father before me have delivered, but just in a different context. And so that part of the job, I really, and it's more than a job, actually, it's a calling, I find very, very rewarding.
Mark, it's been an absolute pleasure. The time has just flown. I think we could talk for hours, and we'd love you to come on the podcast regularly as a guest if you would.
Oh, I would love to.
For those who don't follow Mark, it will enhance your life, I can tell you. It's one of my favorite things to do. Thank you, Mark. We wish you all the very best. Thank you for your honesty and frankness, your warmth. And it's been a really wonderful experience talking to you at Oncology Journal Club podcast.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been an absolute delight, and I wish you the best. And wherever your listeners are, I hope they're staying safe as well.
Well, it's a great pleasure to introduce Heidi Probst. Heidi, hello and welcome.
Hello. Thank you.
Heidi, we found you on Twitter, where most of our podcast interviewees come. And we found you with your tweet of a piece that you wrote about tattoos and how much they mark you as a person with cancer. And in that, you put your own perspective. So going back, you're a professor of radiotherapy and oncology in the UK. at Sheffield Hallam University. It's what we in Australia would call a professor of radiation therapy, not a medical radiation oncology, the radiation therapist. Is that correct?
That's right, yes. So I qualified in the UK, we call them therapeutic radiographers, but as you say, in other parts of the world, they're called radiation therapists.
And Heidi, would you bring us up to speed with your story and what's happened since?
Yeah, so I was practicing as a therapeutic radiographer for about 14 years in the UK as a clinical radiographer, and then I moved into academia after I completed my PhD. My PhD was in the field of breast cancer and breast radiotherapy, and that's the area of my research. So in 2018, unfortunately, I was diagnosed with stage 2B breast cancer myself. And I'll be honest, it came as a bit of a shock. I had always thought that I was probably quite low risk, having studied and been really involved in breast cancer. That's my topic I teach. I teach it to healthcare practitioners at master's level. So I was very aware of the potential risk factors. I was very fit. I have paid a lot of attention to keeping fit and exercising well and eating well. And there's no history of breast cancer in my family. So it did come as quite a bolt out of the blue, to be honest. And as this is the area that I do all my research in, kind of didn't feel like it was part of the plan to be then on the other side of the fence as a patient. So that was in 2018. I had surgery, chemotherapy and radiotherapy, and I finished all my treatment at the beginning of 2019.
So Heidi, people can't see you. I can as we record this. You're lovely, tall, thin and young. You are a former gymnast.
That's right. Yes. Yeah.
And a runner.
Yep. Yep. And I've done that all my life. And I know, I think everybody has that feeling of when you get a diagnosis of cancer, oh, why has this happened to me? I've tried to do everything I possibly can. But I think as well, I've treated a lot of breast cancer patients over the years, and I was realistic to enough when I did get diagnosed to realize actually it is pretty indiscriminate getting a diagnosis of breast cancer, and I've met plenty of patients over the years who probably fit the same bill as me, who really have done everything they possibly can to reduce their risk, but it happens anyway.
And how old were you, Heidi?
So I was 52 when I was diagnosed.
Oh, you look a lot younger than that. And you were living at home with your kids and partner?
Yeah. So I live with my husband and I have two children. My husband is also an oncologist. He doesn't specialize in breast, but he specializes in prostate cancer. And that was difficult, I think, having so much knowledge in the family. And it became difficult as the journey went on, to be honest, because obviously, he has insight and understanding, especially when I went through chemotherapy. I think it was quite tough for him in terms of how I struggled a bit with chemotherapy, to be honest. I didn't find it easy. And after my first cycle, for example, I felt unwell. I had a sore throat and contacted the health team straight away. And of course, they have protocols, and their protocol was to just sit and wait. Whereas my husband, as an oncologist, would deal with his patients quite differently. So it was quite difficult for him to be a partner supporting and caring, and yet seeing the management slightly different to the way that he would maybe perhaps have managed his own patients. So I think it was quite difficult for him. And I think probably that's one of the things that I've realized as I've gone through the journey that I hadn't realized before, is how difficult it is for those people around the cancer patient. I was smothered with friends, family, colleagues supporting. I got all the pamper packages from the hospital, the days, this, everything. Partner gets nothing. They're kind of very much on the periphery, but they're taking all of the stress and the support and trying to work at the same time. I think it was quite difficult for him. He was trying to keep his clinics going. He didn't want to let his colleagues down, didn't want to let his patients down. So he was trying to keep those clinics going, but attend chemotherapy with me every time I went and make sure he was there for me. So I think it was really tough on him. And I have two children. I have a son who's got a job, he's left university, he's working. But at the time of my diagnosis, he'd just started a new job in a new city. So it was all quite stressful for him. So I was really conscious of not making things worse for him at a difficult time. I wanted to be there as a parent. And my daughter was 10 when I was diagnosed, and that was quite tough. So sort of managing all of that was difficult.
So Heidi, your husband's a medical oncologist or radiation or clinical oncologist?
Clinical oncologist, yeah.
Okay. So we don't have that in Australia, but in UK, mainly for bowel and prostate cancer, and the clinical oncologist does both the radiation and the chemotherapy.
That's right. Yeah.
So Heidi, did you choose to go to practitioners that you knew personally and the hospital system where you worked or where your husband worked, or did you deliberately go elsewhere?
No, I went to my local hospital. I didn't choose. My husband works in the main city where we live, but I went to my local hospital for all of my diagnostic tests and my surgery. However, in the UK, the radiotherapy is only delivered in major radiotherapy centres. So my closest radiotherapy centre was actually the centre where I used to work. So I did know a lot of the staff. It's been a while since I worked there, but I still work closely with them. I collaborate with them on research projects and they input to our teaching. So I know a lot of the team really well. It was a difficult one, that in that it was great because I knew them and I was comfortable with them, but also our students attend that radiotherapy centre and I had a bit of anxiety around this is difficult, seeing them as a professor and a teacher and then seeing them as a patient, how would I deal with that? But I have to say the radiotherapy department and the staff were absolutely amazing. They didn't put a foot wrong. Basically, they supported me all of the way. And I think it was difficult for them because they knew how much I knew about the topic and radiotherapy. I'd lived and breathed it for many years, but they treated me as an individual and based on the knowledge that I had. And they were very open and they listened to my concerns. And you referred to the article that I wrote for the conversation, which was about tattoos. And that was one of my areas of concern for the radiotherapy was having tattoos, and they were really considerate in that respect.
And Heidi, did they make any mistakes that you had to point out to them?
No, luckily they didn't. They didn't make a mistake, but when I first went to see the clinical oncologist, she talked me through the process, even though I knew what the process was. And she said, "Oh, and just to remind you that we will be tattooing." I said, I don't want the tattoos. I'm really would prefer not to have them. And she said at that point, "Oh, we don't treat anybody without tattoos." And I was pretty sure that they did because I worked there and I knew lots of things that they did and that lots of patients had refused to have tattoos. So we did have a little bit of a discussion. And then she kind of referred me on to the radiographers or to the radiation therapists, and they worked with me in terms of how to get around not having the tattoos. And I did have one tattoo in the end. I had one just on the side, the lateral position. And then I had some pen marker in the middle with some tape and fake skin dressing. And I avoided washing that area, which wasn't great for 3 weeks. But when you've had surgery and you've had to avoid washing and you've had pick lines that you've had to deal with and not wash, it's fine. You get used to that. So they didn't do anything wrong that I had to point out at all. But there was a little bit of a barrier to begin with about the tattoos that I had to overcome. But they took that on board really well.
And once you were through the treatment, did you go back to your previous role and what was different about it?
Yeah, I tried actually to work all the way through having treatment. My employer were really good about that in terms of allowing me to do things when I felt well, particularly through chemotherapy on the good weeks. So I wanted to do that because I was quite fearful of having a massive break and then having to come back. And I felt that it might be difficult to overcome the barrier to coming back. So keeping my hand in was helpful. And I learned quite early on to separate myself from teaching and talking about breast cancer and the emotions that it brought me as a breast cancer patient. And I did it a couple of times I had a couple of dissertation students who were doing research projects on breast cancer related issues. And I thought, gosh, this is going to be a little bit tough. But actually, the students were fantastic. And I was open about the fact that actually I'm going through breast cancer treatment. And it helped actually to be able to be open about it. And so I learned quite early on to disassociate myself between being professional me and being patient me, so that when I came back and when I'd finished radiotherapy, I felt able to just come back quite easily. It is interesting, I would say, because my last treatment was the radiotherapy and I felt so empowered during my radiotherapy that I did feel able to move on and to go back to work quite easily. During chemotherapy, it was slightly different. I had a really tough time during the chemotherapy, as I mentioned. I didn't feel well. I lost my hair. I used the cold cap and it didn't work. And for some reason, it knocked me for six. But also, halfway through my chemotherapy, I was in a clinical trial, which I opted to join. A fantastic trial. It's the Optima study. But halfway through my chemotherapy, the local hospital decided that I couldn't continue to have my chemotherapy at that hospital and stay in the clinical trial. They said I had to either come out of the clinical trial or I had to travel an hour down the road and have my chemotherapy somewhere else. I found that quite distressing. I didn't understand it as a researcher. I couldn't understand the decision behind it. So there was a bit of a difficult period where I struggled to get my voice heard with the health professionals. So both myself and my husband were a bit confused. And even though we were both in the field and I was a researcher, I understood ethics, I understood all the governance, I did find it difficult to be a patient and not have a voice. And it had a huge impact on me. I felt very disempowered. And even though I did eventually go and have my treatment an hour's drive away and the staff were amazing, by the time I'd got to my radiotherapy appointments, with the journey at that point and having lost my hair and feeling quite dreadful, I was really depressed. I was really struggling. And for the first time I met the clinical oncologist, I just couldn't stop crying. I found it really difficult to speak. But then going through the radiotherapy process, I was really well informed. I thought the staff looked after me brilliantly. I felt really empowered. And then, so as that was my finishing experience of treatment, I just found it much easier to move on to the next stage and to return back to work. I think if I'd had to do it straight after chemotherapy, I would have really, really struggled, to be honest. I think that process of losing yourself, losing who you are as part of the journey is quite a big thing. And I think how people deal with you, and I think it's probably one of the things I've learned most about being a patient on the other side, it's really important how that experience of how people support you and deal with you in the health environment, allowing you and facilitating you to move on and to return. It's a new life because you're not the same person that you were, but allowing you to cope and to pick up and carry on.
So Heidi, fear of recurrence and worrying about the future is part of every cancer diagnosis. What impact does that being a professional practicing in that field have on that fear of recurrence?
Oh, well, you're absolutely right. I think it's probably heightened. I know it's an issue for a lot of patients, but I don't think there is a single day, not one single day, that I don't think about my own breast cancer and worry about it returning. And I think that is probably one of the most difficult things and probably one of the things that I didn't anticipate prior to becoming a cancer patient and probably downplayed it in terms. In my research, a lot of the research I've done, when I've spoken a lot to cancer patients and they talk a lot about their experiences in the journey and fear of recurrence does come out of it. But I think as a professional, I feel heightened response to that. And every single day I think about it.
Do you think having the experience has made you a better practitioner, in inverted commas? People sometimes say it was the worst thing, but it was good in some way for me. How do you feel?
I think it's given me a different perspective. And I think what it has done has given me even more passion and drive for the research that I'm doing. My research is in radiotherapy and improving the delivery of radiotherapy for breast cancer patients. And it's about, we've developed a support bra for women. It's about improving dose to organs at risk, but it's also about dignity and modesty. And one of the things that I struggled with when I went for my radiotherapy was like undressing in front of people when you've got an altered body image. You're not the person that you were months before. And so I appreciated that even more. And it gave me an even bigger passion and drive to do the research that we're doing. And research is difficult, isn't it? We have come up against barriers all the time in developing this medical device, but it's given me a stronger sense of why it is important to carry on and why it is important to support patients. And the other thing I suppose it has done is I already understood from previous cancer patients about this disempowerment. I felt empowered during my radiotherapy, but that's not how all patients feel. And speaking to cancer patients as part of our research, that is one something that they mentioned. They feel out of control. They have no control in the process. And so one of the things we try and to do with our research is to give something back to them in terms of helping them to self-monitor some of their side effects. And so it's really given me the impetus to really push on and realize how important that is. I want all patients that have breast radiotherapy to feel as empowered as I did. They don't have the insight and the information that I had, and I want all patients to have that. I want them all to feel that they understand the process before they go and that they have some role to play in their own treatment and not just to be having treatment done to them, but they have a role to play as well and they're part of it.
Absolutely. And may I ask, how do you think this experience has changed your husband's attitude to his practice of cancer?
Yeah, that's a really, really good question. I think it has made him appreciate actually the role of the carer and the partner and the impact it has, not just on that individual who's got the cancer, but the wider sphere of the family unit. I think it's helped him with his communications with patients. I'm very biased because I think he's a great doctor anyway. I worked with him when I was a clinical radiographer and he is a great doctor. But I think it has helped him appreciate that communication process, talking to families, to patients and their carers, and that sort of two-way process of understanding what's happening to them as a family.
And what about his anxiety or fear of recurrence? Because that's a real thing for carers as well.
I think the difficulty for him was around when I first thought I had a lump, and you know, obviously I got him to check it out as an oncologist, and at first we were like, he was a bit unsure and he thought, oh, I don't think it's anything. And we left it for a little while and then it didn't go away and it seemed to get bigger. And I think that's left an anxiety in him in terms of he didn't spot it early enough. And so I think anything I have now in terms of a pain or a twinge, he's self-doubting himself because of the experience that I had. So it has a long enduring impact on us both as a couple and professionally in terms of second guessing himself in terms of his role. It's difficult for him to separate himself as an oncologist and a husband sometimes.
Absolutely. Look, Heidi, it's been just precious to hear your story and perspectives and the perspective of your whole family. And you've been very generous sharing with us. Is there anything else you'd like to say from your experience as a cancer professional who's had cancer?
I suppose one thing, I've probably mentioned this already, but I think all the way through my journey, there are different things that happen along the way. And maybe I don't think it's new, but something that I sort of really appreciated more as a patient is the little things that healthcare practitioners do that make a huge difference. The one thing that sort of sticks in my mind is the receptionist in the MRI, actually, who I went for an MRI just after I'd had my fourth operation, sat in a big gown in a waiting room full of men, feeling quite anxious. And she spotted the anxiety on my face, took me to one side, put me somewhere private where I didn't feel quite so exposed. It's those little things that make a massive difference. And yes, we want to have good diagnostics and local control and survival is really, really important. I'm not denying all of that. But sometimes it's the little things that just make it bearable. And I suppose that's the one thing I would remember. Those little things around dignity and modesty really make a massive difference, I think.
No better note to finish on, Heidi. You've brought tears to my eyes. I thank you very, very much. Wish you all the best for the future and let's keep in touch.
Lovely. Yes, absolutely. Thank you for inviting me. It's been lovely to talk to you.
Well, this has been, I have to say, I think my favourite episode yet of Oncology Journal Club, because the insights that we've had and the generosity of our guests is just extraordinary and something I think that we all can relate to on one level and yet can't really relate to on another. It's been really fascinating insight. I hope you've enjoyed this special edition of Oncology Journal Club.
You've been listening to the Oncology Podcast. If you enjoyed today's edition and would like to subscribe, head over to our website, oncologynews.com.au, and sign up to our newsletter. Thanks for listening.